Welcome to Big Talk for Breeders. My name is Michael Doherty, a show jumping breeder from the west of Ireland. And in each episode, I'll bring you a new interview with a successful sport horse breeder. Thanks for checking out the podcast. Now let's get started. This is episode number 17 with Irish breeder and stallion owner Mary McCann of Hartwell Stud. Many of you will know Mary as the breeder and owner of the highly successful Irish sport horse stallion Cruising. And now Hartwell Stud also stand his two stallion clones. The other voices that you will hear during this interview are David McCann, Mary's husband, and Gina McCann, Mary's daughter. What initially drew you to the horse industry? And then when did things first begin here in Hartwell Stud?
As a child, we rode ponies from Churchtown Road in Dublin. And we had a pony in the back garden. So I suppose I started to ride at the age of about 8.
Okay.
And then I rode a very good pony called Whiskey in the spring show for Jackie Doherty when I was 10. And I suppose that started all off.
Okay.
And then met David, and we were married 50 years this year. And this place has been going since about... this place has been going since about... 1880, I think, the first, as a stud, the first Clydesdales, David's grandfather bought in from Scotland.
So and, is this your home place?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And they, in those days, they used to take them from village to village.
Yeah, the stallion travelled. They walked the stallion,
and I think they must have gone back 3 weeks later then.
So we should go back to that day. Wouldn't it be awful handy for us as mare owners? none of this driving up to Hartwell.
No.
Come down to Sligo.
Yeah, exactly. And they walked. And they did a 3 week round trip then. You know, 3 weeks' time, the mare would be back in season if she wasn't a foal. And they go back around to cover again. So I suppose they did the same sort of thing as they did in, you know, the amount of mares they covered is probably something like the way they used Coolmore, you know, 7 in the morning, 12 or maybe even more.
So when did you start on the stallion end here in Hartwell?
I think we sort of walked into it because we started off with Ashby Bobby Sparrow.
Okay.
We bought him as a stallion. He was a 5-year-old. We bought him from a very nice gentleman up in Donegal. And we brought down, I think, 5 ponies that time. There were some good mares as well. And he was a stallion then, and we just went and broke him and went on, and that's really what started it.
Well, so at the time you bought him at 5, he hadn't done anything.
He wasn't even broken, no.
And what drew you to him?
Jimmy Jones, I think.
He was giving up or something. You know?
Yeah, he was in a place called Mount Charles up in Donegal.
Okay.
And Jimmy Jones, who bred Ashby Bobby Sparrow, said that there was Connemara's for sale up there,
mm-hmm.
and we should go up and see them. And David and I went up, and we took April Merveld, Countess Merveld, mm-hmm. with us. And a funny little story there, because we were going through Keady, and April was knitting in the front of the car, and I was sitting in the back, and we were stopped for ages, and I looked out, and here's all these fellas with guns trained on us. And April was totally... didn't bother a jot, just went on knitting. I thought we'd be all shot. Anyway, we went up and we bought Ashby Bobby, and we bought a very good mare that jumped open out. It was called Gay Patra. And then Alan Storm bought one of them first that went to his family in
Belgium.
And the other one, Gay Roberta, she was really good. She was... jumped here for years on the hunter pony scene, and she went to England with the pony club. And that's what started off, really. And then people wanted to use Ashby Bobby. So we started that way.
There was a serious strike rate out of that purchase then.
Unbelievable, yeah. But they were a good old stock Connemara, you know, with blood.
Mm.
They had blood, but they had strength and power as well. You know, there's two different ways of going now. We've got the show Connemara and the jumping Connemara.
And actually, and that's it. And it wasn't something that I was planning on bringing up tonight, but you've hit on a good point there. For those that are jumping orientated within the Connemara world, with the closed stud book for so long, for the last whatever it is. Maybe it's, I don't know, is it closed for 30 plus years?
Oh, it's more than that. I think
it's or maybe the 70s.
I think the last one that got in, thoroughbred wise, would have been Little Heaven.
Little Heaven.
Yeah.
And how do you think, for those that want to breed pure Connemaras, how do you keep enough blood in those ponies to make it relevant for modern-day jumping?
That's my argument too, because the modern-day jumping pony, modern-day jumping Connemara has to come up with a modern-day half-bred pony.
Yeah.
And they are doing it to a certain degree. I mean, I think one of the most brilliant ponies of them all would be Black Woodland Rock. Mm-hmm. And he's jumped for, I think, 5 different countries in 5 different years on the European team with 5 different kids.
He was here for a while, wasn't he?
He's still going, yeah. We've Rose Seaman from here. He's a lovely pony. But I mean, when you see him jumping a 130 track, he looks like a horse. He jumps beautifully. But you go to see the show Connemaras in Dublin. They'll all jump to a certain height, but they won't have that absolute ability that the like of Black Woodland Rock had, as still alive and kicking. But there's a definite, it's like the show jumping and the eventing. Now, the breed for show jumping, a breed for eventing in the sport horse industry. There's definitely a breed for showing Connemaras, and now the jumping Connemaras coming to the fore. I think will come to the fore more and more.
During your time in the, well, I suppose in breeding in general, I was going to say on the stallion side, but in breeding in general, what changes in the industry are you most happy to see? And then what are the changes that concern you the most throughout, say, from the time that you started to now?
I think now somebody said to me once, and I quite agree with them, that we breed off the television.
Yeah.
And I'd be very worried about that, because you see a good horse jumping a 150 track on the television, 160 track maybe on the television. But I'm afraid our foreign horses don't last as long as long health-wise and physical wise, if you like. I should have a better word for that, but I don't have it. The way that the Irish horse used to have years and years and years ago, they used to jump until they were 19 and 20. But I mean, you see this horse jumping on the television, you can order in the semen, you get the semen in, you get your mare and foal, no bother. And then maybe 3 years later, when it's maybe 12 or 13, it's gone, it's had it. It just can't keep going physically. I do feel that. And then what happens is you've got your foal and you go to Gore's Bridge and you've only got to look at the foal sales at the moment. Half the horses in it, people have never even heard of.
Yeah. On the soundness issue, what do you think it is that makes that difference between the Irish horses and the Warmlands?
Well, I'm wondering, is it going to go on? Because I think years ago, we might hunt our four-year-olds at the back end of the season. We used to hunt them a bit. But we didn't really start to jump horses till they were 5. Mm. We now see on the continent the jumping foals. I mean, that just is madness. The physical makeup of a horse, they tell me their backs don't fuse until they're 6. So what damage are we doing? Unbelievable damage. I mean, everywhere, the international teams now, they bring their physiotherapist with them. Their back man goes along as well. Surely that's wrong. Surely that we can breed horses that can don't have to have back men when they're 4, 5, and 6, you know, because they're being pressurised so much into the height that they're jumping.
Yeah, but I suppose now, maybe in the past, the horses were started later. But you'd have to think that the young horses in Ireland are now nearly doing
than
in Holland or Belgium.
It's too much. I mean, these three-year-olds, what they've been asked to jump is ridiculous. And it's all this flamboyant jumping. You know, it's not easy for them.
Mm.
It's all this flamboyant jumping. And, I mean, half the time their backs go at a very early stage and need help.
And are there any trends that you've seen or any changes that you've seen that you would see now as a positive in the direction things are going or in the approach that breeders are taking?
I don't. There has to be positives, because people can breed the best to the best. If they have a really good mare, they can get in their semen and breed the best to the best. But I mean, if they're going to be trying to sell them as 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds and jumping them over 120 square, you know, when they're 2-year-olds, they have to be doing damage. And we're going that way as well. I mean, I honestly think that the amount of jumping that a 3-year-old has to go through, let's say, to qualify for Dublin and go to Dublin. And somebody said to me recently that the 5-year-olds in Lanarkin, even the amount that they have to do, 5-year-olds in Lanarkin, that I don't know whether this is right or not, but I was told that there isn't a 5-year-old that jumped in Lanarkin and won that has made the top grade. So am I right or wrong? I don't know.
Just off the cuff, I think Garant that Willem Greve won the 5-year-olds with in Lanarkin, I don't know how many years ago.
And Lanarkin's going 30 years
BZ
now.
BZ Madden's top horse. There was, I think it was maybe Hippomondo did some stats on that, but I can't remember. But it is concerning when you are there. It's fine to go and watch as a spectator.
Exactly.
But even there last month, I was thinking if I had a nice 5-year-old, would I like it to be competing here? Because there are so many horses. You're starting with 200 plus horses in each age category. What they've had to do to get selected to go there is often a lot. But then when they're there, a clear round isn't even guaranteeing you. Like a double clear. So like a clear, say, on Thursday and a clear on Friday doesn't guarantee you're in the final on Sunday. It has to be one of the fastest clears as well. And it's just, I would agree with you on that. I'd be concerned.
I just wonder, what worries me is how many do we lose along the way?
Yeah.
That if they were taken a bit more slowly, they were let mature. It's more the show jumping than, well, even the eventing, the 4-year-olds eventing now. It blows half of their minds. So, you know, it's hard for people. It's their livelihood and they want to sell their 4-year-olds and their 5-year-olds and get as much money as possible. So they want to go to go for gold and they want to go to, you know, whatever. But I don't think it's doing them any good along the way. It's the ones we lose.
Yeah. And I suppose that's, if you do look at the stats of how many horses are bred versus how many reach the top, there is an awful lot of wastage. And I know sometimes accidents happen even with the best systems in place, but you would have to wonder where all these.
But years ago, 30 years ago, let's say, and you'd be watching Wembley or something like that on the television, and year after year you'd see the same horses coming in. But that doesn't happen anymore. They don't last. You might see the same, those top 200. They don't last more than 3 or 4 years at that level.
Do you think over the last few decades in the stallion business, do you think it's becoming harder to be a stallion owner or are things getting more straightforward?
No, I think it's harder. Much, much harder. Much, much harder. I think the good thing about it is that people are getting more educated about how to go about, you know, getting their mares right and that sort of thing. Because years ago, we used to have a lorry load of mares that come in and they'd have a rope around their neck. Now, that's gospel. You know, there'd be 4 or 5 would be got out and some of them would have a rope around their neck and there'd be 3-year-olds and they wouldn't even be caught. I mean, that's gone now and that's brilliant that it has gone. But
we had one went down the motorway.
Yeah.
With the stallion after.
You know, it doesn't happen anymore, thank be to God. Thank be to God for AI.
Is that Brookside?
No, it was Seacrest.
No, it was Seacrest.
Oh, that story sounds familiar.
The Seacrest, and he had his...
It was a thoroughbred mare, I think.
Yeah.
She must have been a lovely mare after her down
the motorway. There's your health and safety. Never let an owner hold his own mare. If you're going to, you know, if you're going to do a natural cover.
The guards picked up a shoe in the village.
And it burnt his hand.
And it burnt his hand.
And I think it's still in the.
Well, I don't know whether it is or not.
But he put it up over the door in the guard station.
They were down the middle of the motorway. And then Seacrest gave up.
Down the middle of the green grass in the motorway, we were very lucky because in those days it was traffic lights in Johnstown and traffic lights at Kill. And evidently the lorries started up and the lorry, two lorries coming towards each other saw the horse was galloping down the middle of the green grass and pulled up and stopped all the traffic.
Because it could have ended badly.
No, it could. Yeah.
Just a short while ago, we were discussing thoroughbred stallions and the difficulty in finding new options. How do you think the thoroughbreds of today, even in terms of type, pedigree, or what's available, how do you think thoroughbreds of today differ from those that were available 20 or 30 years ago? Or do you see any major differences?
I think there was more thoroughbreds available 30, 40 years ago. You know, we didn't have the rules and regulations, and they could cover halfbreds. Well, I mean, they still can if they want to. Mm-hmm. But the thoroughbred people don't want, even if they've a nice stallion at €1,000, people would go to them. But they don't want to have the stigma of being seen to be covering half-bred horses, mm-hmm. or even sport horses now. But when I go back to think of probably the first horse that I remember being so successful was Water Serpent. Mm-hmm. And when you think of Water Serpent wasn't big. Water Serpent was about 16 hands, and he was the worst mover I ever saw in my life. And look what he bred.
And why do you think he succeeded then?
I don't know, though. There had to be some sort of genetics there that really clicked with the half-bred. You know, because it's two different things. And then those days, it was the Irish draft mare that was pulling the plough, and she was hunting on a Sunday and pulling the plough the rest of the time, or taking the milk to the creamery. And he covered a lot of mares like that, and look what he got.
And do you think there has been much change in the actual type of the horse, type of the thoroughbred that's there today?
Well, there possibly is. A lot of people thought that the best jumpers, I don't know whether this is true or not, because I could never fathom out whether it was or not, that the best jumpers were sprinters, because they were short and strong and that sort of thing. And that the National Hunt horse wouldn't, the National Hunt stallion wouldn't breed a show jumper. I remember hearing that too, but I still have my doubts. From my point of view,
it seems like the reverse of what kind of nearly logic.
Exactly. I mean, when you think of the sprinters, they've got a big, strong behind, and you think of the quarter horse, if you like, in America, with a big, strong behind. I mean, they don't breed jumpers. The quarter horse doesn't breed jumpers, and I don't think a sprinter would necessarily breed a jumper either.
When you're going out, say for instance, if you were going out now to pick a thoroughbred stallion for one of your own mares, either to breed to or to stand, what are the most important things that you're looking for, or you want to see in that horse?
Well, he's got to make you turn around and say, "Oh, I like that horse," you know, straight off. He's got to give you a feeling that you like him, and then he's got to move. I think movement is an awful lot to do with what we require in our show jumpers and in our event horses.
And are you specifically looking at trot, or do you want to see more
canter?
Yeah.
Mm. Okay. A good strong canter that is a little bit airlifted, if you like, a little bit airborne. You know, and I mean, I love looking at the foals here. I often go out and look at the foals, and when they're young. And you can see it after even a few days that they're cantering around in a small field, and they sort of go near the head fence and they do a flying change and they canter off in the other way. And when you see that, I mean, you know, they're not falling around the place, they're balanced. It's a lovely sight, isn't it?
That day two or three is lovely.
It's
just
lovely.
When they've finally kind of found their feet.
They found their feet and they're cantering around, mother, they're bucking and kicking, and they suddenly see the fence in front of them and they do a flying change and go off in the other direction. And I love to see that, because I do think that follows through their life.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you said that, because a mare that I had last year, the foal that she was having when we lost her was a filly, and then everyone was automatically saying, "Oh, that's a keeper."
Yeah.
But I said, it's not a keeper until she shows me that she's a keeper.
Exactly.
Because otherwise, if I'm completely ruled by sentiment, my breeding program won't end well. And I remember that day two or three when I let her out in the paddock and I saw the canter, the athleticism of this filly. I thought, now you're a keeper.
Yeah. They have to trot straight. I mean, they have to be straight movers. But for me, the canter is more important.
And is there anything that really, really puts you off
well, I suppose specifically with staying on thoroughbreds for the moment, do you have any like real non-negotiables or things that is, if you see in a thoroughbred stallion, it's a non-runner for you?
I don't like a peacocky stallion. Do you know what I mean by a peacocky stallion? A horse with a high head carriage, and do you know what I mean? His sort of his head and his neck is way above his his wither. Do you know what the sort of thing I mean? I don't like that, because I don't think you can ever get them down
into a shape.
Into a shape, exactly, and get them the muscle from their wither up along their neck that they're going to be able to carry themselves properly.
Yeah.
But that's me.
Yeah.
Not necessarily saying it's right or wrong, but I just don't like the look of it.
Moving on to one of the, I suppose, most iconic presences that has been in Hartwell Stud, obviously Cruising. Can we go back to like the initial creation of Cruising and how that came about, and also how it ended up? Because my understanding is that you really took control of all the key components to create them, but on paper you're not the official breeder.
Mm.
And would you mind explaining, how his creation came about?
We were asked to take Seacrest as a three-year-old.
Yeah.
And I went to the stud where Seacrest was on to see him. I think you were with me, weren't you?
Could have been.
And Seacrest, who was quite a blocky three-year-old. You know, he wasn't a big draft.
Okay.
And he was a beautiful mover. I think that's what sort of stood to him, with the amount of good event horses he then bred. And when I was there, I heard this mare coughing in a field at the back of this stud farm in outside the Curragh. And I knew the young man that was there that was looking after her. I said, "What's that coughing like that?" And he said, "Oh, it's Mother Crewe." And I knew that Mother Crewe had been owned by Joe McGrath. And I came home and I rang Joe, because I was very friendly with Joe at the time. And I said to him,
"Gordon O'Goppen owned her at that time."
She had been given to Borden O'Goppen by the army.
From the army, yeah.
This is when Borden O'Goppen was still in Tallaght.
Okay.
And was Borden O'Goppen. And anyway, I rang Joe and I said to Joe that Mother Crewe was over there. And did he know? And he said no. And he rang me up about 3 days later and said, "Would you go and collect Mother Crewe from over there?" Well, I said, "I've already collected Seacrest and for Borden O'Goppen, and they paid me to break him here and to take him to Mill Street and that sort of thing." In fact, we suggested we'd go to Mill Street with Seacrest, because he was looking very good as a, you know, as a jumping draft, and nobody'd ever done that before.
That's what I was going to ask, that nobody had ever performance tested
a draft before. Well, that, I'm wrong in that respect, because Pat Hutchinson jumped King of Diamonds.
Okay.
You know, as I can still see him in Kilkenny Show, actually. He jumped King of Diamonds. Anyway, we collected Mother Crewe and brought her back here. And I think Jim Norton at the time had some say in that as well. And she had been at another stud and hadn't been 2 years running and hadn't gone in foal.
So, and she had never bred at this point?
She'd never bred.
Okay.
Anyway, we brought her back here, and I think that was in the spring, and she was quite a nervy mare, quite a worried mare. Would you call her worried, David? She was worried about everything, you know. Anyway, we had her here, and we eventually got her covered, and she had a cold foal.
Yeah.
I was paid by the Borden O'Goppen to look after her. I can't remember, it was something like 20 quid a week in those days. To look after her, and they sold the foal. They owned the foal, and they sold the foal, and it went to Goffs, and I think it made 3,500, and Old C. Duggan bought it. And it ended up a horse called Steel Dust.
Mm. And he castrated him.
He castrated him, that's right, and he got some sort of eye infection down there, and they thought it wasn't going to be right, but he came right. And he went out to, what was his name? Erica.
Yeah, East Coast, I think.
It wasn't De La Hoya, was it?
No. Oh, what was his name?
Or Fargus.
Fargus. Joe Fargus.
Joe, I couldn't think of the first name.
Joe Fargus jumped him. And funnily enough, another bit of that story was that Vivian Munden, who used to work for Paul Darragh, went out to work out there. And she rang me up and said, "Would you know what's out here?" She said, "Steel Dust is out here, and he's just won the Young Horse Championship in Miami as a six-year-old. But he fell and he broke his kneecap or something, and they stitched him up, but he was only an amateur after that.
Okay.
He didn't come out."
So he was the 1984 foal.
What was cruising? 85.
Yeah.
No.
No, it was a year. But
there was a gap, was there?
They couldn't cover with a foal at foot.
Oh, okay, so he was 83.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then we got her right over the winter, but they were still paying me to keep her. And they stopped paying me then after the first foal because they wanted her put down. And I said, you know, I've got her here ready. That was came up to her that she was sold in the November sale, so about the following January, if you get me.
Okay.
And she hadn't gone and foaled with the foal. We hadn't been able to cover her with a foal on her. And they wanted her put down. And I got in an awful state because I'd fed her all winter and her feet were in a terrible state. You know, we did a lot of trouble with her feet and trying to keep her feet right, but we kept them right. And she was looking very well and healthy by the time March, April came. And as I said, they wanted us to put her down. And I again rang Joe and Jim Norton and said, "Look, this is ridiculous. This mare, she's, you know, an international mare. Beautifully bred. And we'll have to, you know, try and get them to change their minds." So they came and they did an agreement with me that I would keep her and I would have full charge of what she was going to do and I would have the offspring. And Tommy Ryan, do you remember Tommy Ryan? Captain Tommy Ryan? Tommy was in charge of that. I have a letter here from Tommy on that. And the big problem with Bord na Coppel at the time was that they were leasing out mares, draft mares, but they were also leasing out mares that had jumped by the army. And they leased out a mare to a certain person in the north of Ireland as a brood mare. And the next thing, she was back jumping again.
Right.
And there was war over that. So because of that, they wouldn't change the passports.
The ownership.
The ownership of the passport. And that's the whole reason that this has all come up, because we never changed it. But they never changed, from then on, they never changed any of the, especially with the draft mares, they didn't change the ownership in the passports. You were given the offspring. You looked after the mares, you were given the offspring. But the passports were never changed.
Okay, so you were, by default, you were the owner, but you were never recognised then on paper
exactly,
as being the breeder.
Exactly, and that's literally, it is just the paper. And as I say, I have Captain Tommy Ryan, the letter here from Captain Tommy Ryan, stating that Mary McCann was in charge of the whole thing and had the offspring, and there was a, but you know, nothing was ever said about this until cruising got
successful.
And then a certain person tried to bring it to the Dáil. There was to be a question asked in the Dáil that why wasn't the army giving back secret cruising? And this was when cruising was, I think he just won the, what was the first, he won the when he was nine, he was on, I think it was nine, he was on the team in Pavarotti's. And they'd won the Nations Cup. And the next thing, this came up. And it was Tommy Brennan rang me up and said, there's a certain person trying to claim that the army owned cruising and he should be put into the army.
Okay.
But that didn't happen until he was
performing
at that level. Mm-hmm. So now you have the whole thing, and that's it in a nutshell.
And even rolling back to his earlier years, though, I suppose if they were going to go that route, it was probably strange that that didn't happen earlier on, because he was successful from the get-go, really,
he started producing him as a five-year-old. As a five-year-old, Paul had him as a five-year-old, and I think we worked it out. He only jumped in, he actually, it was the year of that awful flu in Dublin when he was a four-year-old. Mark Kyle qualified him for the American Hunter, and we went to go in the American Hunter just to, you know, educate him as a four-year-old, because in those days, there was no jumping four-year-olds much at all, and that was sort of a little way of getting him educated.
Mm.
And he got the bad flu, I'll never forget that year in the RDS. You walked in the door, one line of boxes was coughing one day, and the next day the whole blinking show was coughing. And the dirt at the coming out of their noses was terrible. That was the first really bad influenza. So that must have been in... Cruising was born in 1989 it must have been.
Yeah.
And then the next year he was in pause. And I think he only jumped in about six shows before he went to Dublin. Because Paul was able to...
As an international writer could nominate.
Nominated. He could nominate them in those days. And he was nominated. And he went and won the Guinness. The Guinness.
Yeah. But it wasn't called the Guinness.
No,
that
I know.
Year.
I get into trouble all the time. But the big thing was that Bord na Gcapall was down as breeding the horse in the power sport.
Yes.
And I couldn't change that because they wouldn't change it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was. They wouldn't change it because this mare had been taken up to the north, as I say, and had been showed. I mean, that's all in Tommy Ryan's letter. When Seacrest came here, a certain person came to see him jumping and said it was ridiculous. We shouldn't be bothering to waste money in jumping because he's too small and blah, blah, blah.
But he was actually a good jumper.
He was. Grade A.
But... that didn't go down very well either because I said I'd keep him here, but he then wanted him to go to some fella down the country.
Okay. Can you remember the first moment with Cruising where you thought, right, we have something...
In Dublin that day. He came round the corner and the day he won the Guinness, he came round the corner.
Yeah, but...
What?
But it was Edward, remember?
Oh, yeah.
He said, hey, you better come and have a look at this.
When you were, Cruising made a lot of noise as a 2-year-old and still a colt. And to this day, I don't know why I left him a colt, but anyway, we did leave him a colt.
Just as well.
I'd say probably because he was out of an international mare, you know. And I said to Edward, get him lunging, you know, and get him.
We were away or something.
No, we were going away.
Oh, going away, yeah.
Popping a few poles, and I must admit, I never saw anything like this 2-year-old to trot into a pole and pop a cross pole and then astride and jump another fence. He was just on springs. So I suppose that probably was the first time
that was
we decided.
The first of it, yeah.
And did he always jump like that, kind of cat like?
Yeah. He did.
So then Edward is a 3-year-old, Paul Dara took over at 5, was it?
He took him over at 5, yeah. Paul went on with him. That was 5. He showed nothing at 6 much at all.
Okay.
He'd have one off and be a bit bold and you know. Then he went abroad, didn't he go abroad? Oh, I know, no. I drove him up to Gleneagles with Mary Hoolan in the old lorry and he won the Grand Prix as a 7-year-old up in Gleneagles. And I mean, he took the eyes out of everybody's head up there. And then he came home as an 8-year-old. He didn't do that much either. He went abroad with Paul then. It sort of was his third horse.
Okay. So it was at
8. It must have been the tail end of him being 8.
8.
He'd won that. No, he came home and he won the Grand Prix down in Kellett's here. And Trevor was watching him jump and he came up to me and he said to me, gee, he's fabulous, isn't he? And I said, well, I suppose he is, and that sort of thing. And then because I'd made a connection with Trevor, and Trevor at that stage was jumping the big brown horse he had, what was he called? Can't remember. And I asked Trevor, would he take him? And Trevor said he didn't really want to upset Paul. He said, you're not going to be upsetting anybody. You're going to, that's it. And he took him home, I think. We sent him up anyway, and he was there for about a week. And he went to some show. And he rang me up and said, Mary, I can't ride this horse like riding a motorbike. He says, he just goes by fences. He just gallops past them. And that was all from Paul. And I said, well, you better. I think I said, would you ever do something to me? I said, would you get a pair of spurs or something? I said, because that fella just needs it. They're all pussyfooting around him, which is true, they were. I said, put a pair of running reins on him or something like that. Or do something like that and put a few manners on him and do a bit. You see, the one thing about Paul never rode horses on the flat. I mean, he just jumped them. There was no flat work in them at all. So he gave him a fortnight flat work and he went out and won the next Grand Prix. And he never looked back there. But he still did do you. Cruising, he cost us the World Cup in Gothenburg on the first day he had a run out. And put him about seventh. He'd have been second. He'd have won it. He'd have been a couple of points ahead of Galoubi de Rouet going into the final.
Did he always have a bit of a quirk to him?
Oh, yeah.
Like from the get-go, whenever he started, say, working with him as a three-year-old?
No, we were very, very lucky because we had a very good... We had two Australians here, Michael and his sister.
Goldberg.
Michael Goldberg. Michael Goldberg rode very nicely. And his sister rode even better. She was a dressage rider and they both worked here.
Okay.
But Michael broke cruising as a two-year-old. And in fact, cruising, I can still see cruising with Michael on him as a two-year-old down in Kellett's. We had to do some sort of a display or something like that. And I said, I've just broken a two-year-old. It was near Christmas time. He was nearly three. Mm. And Michael took him down and trotted him around base. And that's the mistake I think we made here with the clones. We should have broken the clones at two. Well, done more with them.
You broke him because he wasn't going to be easy, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
So earlier was better than...
Earlier was better than late. But Michael did a beautiful job on him. He had him riding beautifully.
Is there a particular moment, like you were very involved throughout his career, and I think you would have even brought him to a lot of shows yourself. Is there a particular moment in his career that stands out as being just that bit extra special above the other wins or moments?
Oh, Aachen, I think. He loved Aachen. He was in Aachen for 5 years. And I think I'm right in saying the first year he was in Aachen, he was sixth in the Grand Prix. No, I think he was in Aachen 4 years. I could be a little bit wrong. 4 years. He was sixth in the Grand Prix. The next year he was fourth. The next year he was third. And the fourth year he won it. But he just loved Aachen.
It's incredible.
Jan, that used to look after him with Trevor. She said, Mary, you wouldn't believe it. The second year he went to Aachen, he walked straight into the box that he'd been in the year before.
Yeah, but in those days too, the Nations Cups were the day before the Grand Prix.
Yeah, exactly.
And cruising was on every Nations Cup in those days.
So
Grand Prix then were... Mm. I'd be tired, I suppose, from the next... Yeah. Because the Nations Cups were long.
Yeah. Drawn out things.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right, because I think that the year he won it, the Nations Cup wasn't the day before. It was on the Friday or something. I think there was a gap. You're dead right, yeah. But sure, in those days, we got no money for the Nations Cups.
No prize money?
No.
Jeez, you'd want to fairly love it.
I know.
But sure, most people wouldn't put their top horses into it.
They kept the top horses for the Nations Cup.
For the Grand Prix.
Because it was the only thing there was money in.
I suppose it's a bit like what's happening with the GCTs now versus riders not making their horses available to jump on teams because they're saving them for the Global Champions Tour.
Yeah. Exactly.
We're now seeing cruising as obviously dam sire, grand dam sire, and back through the generations. And a lot of cruising mares now seem to be producing the goods. Is there anything in particular that you think he gave to his daughters that makes him a good dam sire?
I don't think I can put a finger on it. I mean, if you get a good dam sire in racing, if you like, it's usually because they can run faster, or something like that. But I think his cross to the slightly heavier mare, he probably put more blood into them and probably put a sharper mind into them.
Okay.
I think that's a definite thing to say. A lot of people would say probably too sharp a mind, but at the same time, there's no doubt about the fact of the mares that he has produced seem to go on and on producing the goods.
Because when I think, now, it's not that I've been around a huge amount of cruising mares, but when I think of a lot of the good ones, they weren't always the most straightforward. And they had that little bit of maybe a spark in the mind or a toughness in the character.
They had, they had. But the funny thing about them is, I mean, we've broken so many of them here, but when you get to them, they were animals that you didn't go into the stable and grab. You waited till they came to you. And once you got the confidence and they came to you and you broke them that way, you didn't have much problems. But I do feel that, I always said that the worst thing to happen cruising was the Clover Hill came before them, because the Clover Hill mares were so easy, you know, and all the Clover Hill horses were so easy to ride. And then people sort of didn't bother putting the work into a lot of the cruisings. I think we lost a lot of the cruisings along the way.
Okay.
That could have been handled a bit more intelligently.
Yeah. You had made a comment previously about cruising crossing particularly well with French mares and pedigree.
It seems to happen. I don't know why, because I would have thought that cruising was light enough. The way I used to look at them was, I always said that Seacrest bred like a half bred, not a draft, because there was a thoroughbred in his pedigree. Yeah. And the cruising bred like a National Hunt stallion. And the French horse is very much a thoroughbred as well. So for me, I just don't quite understand that, but there's no doubt about it, he bred very well to a French mare.
And do you think that's true? I sometimes think that that can be true to the Irish horses in general, because if you look at a lot of the backbreeding of Irish horses and the backbreeding of French horses, they're often built on a similar thoroughbred foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, is it actually that? Is it its own blood meeting its own blood?
It could well be. I'm very fond of the French bred sport horse. I think you are as well.
Yeah.
I like the French a lot.
And then with the Irish crosses, were there any particular, we'll call them nicks, that you observed over the years that you really, really liked to see? Like a particular cruising on a particular...
Well, there's no doubt about it that he bred particularly well to Clover Hill. And, I mean, there's many, many of them out there, and a lot of them now are the brood mare foundations,
yeah,
of people's studs, of the cruising Clover Hill cross. Can't tell you why that either, because it's just Clover Hill.
Yeah, you
don't really know what.
You do say, too, that if they followed cruising...
That's quite true, yeah. Funny enough, over the years I noted a lot of that cross, if the geldings would more than likely follow the draft side, they were heavier.
With the
cruising Clover Hill cross.
Okay.
And the fillies more followed the cruising side of it.
That's very interesting.
That was a definite thing. I mean, there was a lot of Clover Hill looking geldings that were by cruising, and you sort of look quite and say, that can't be a cruising, but it was. But there were more Clover Hill to look at. So there's genetics up the way. And don't give me anything about this blinking, what they call it?
Linear scoring.
Linear scoring. You can put that where the monkey put the nut. Because as I said to a lot of people, until cows can jump 6 foot and you can milk mares, you can't tell me that you can go linear scoring with all this nonsense.
I would love, like, you know the way you could, in some interviews sometimes, like on the radio or whatever, you'll just get a soundbite before the interview. I'd love to just start, you know, with that and then cut to the interview.
And say nothing else about it.
I stood up at various meetings and said, until you can get a cow to jump 6 foot and a mare to milk 3 gallons a day, where are you going with... Because that's what they copied it from. They copied it from the dairy cow.
Yeah. In terms of cruising's own character traits or characteristics, were there any of those that you saw were passed through to his offspring quite consistently?
Sharpness.
Character or jump? Or both?
Character and jump. He was always very good in front.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to frighten the life out of me. The extraordinary thing about him was, you go to an international show and the first competition you jump in, every freaking horse would be 4 feet in the air over every fence they jumped.
Yeah.
And cruising used to slither over everything, and I'd say, oh God, would he ever get to a clear round? You know what I mean?
Do you mean as in he just did enough?
He just did enough the whole time, yeah. And then his best days were always his last day of the show. and he always pulled it out for the Grand Prix. I don't know whether he needed the work or whether he needed getting used to things, but like he was a bit odd in the respect that he went to the famous show in Glasgow and he wouldn't go in the door because there was a fountain in the corner spraying water everywhere. And I think Trevor couldn't get him in the first day. He eventually was placed in the Grand Prix, but it took him the 3 or 4 days to get that he's put up with looking at the thing in the corner.
Some of the offspring have that quirk as well, don't they? And I remember you saying when we were here doing the Irish Horse TV interview before, I think you mentioned in that about his hatred for donkeys.
Don't think the fear of donkeys is genetic, because I don't think the boys are afraid of donkeys.
No, so they're not. But it was unbelievable. He just had this absolute freak out. And he knocked a whole row of motorbikes down in Le Boule, wasn't it?
I think so.
All the motorbikes were parked, you know, where they parked, or bikes were all parked in a line. And there was a big high hedge. And they had a Spanish ass parade in the main arena. And Trevor came in on the horse, and the horse saw the ears going over the fence, and he freaked. He backed into all the bicycles and knocked the whole lot of them down.
But that is interesting, the point about it not being genetic. That's what must be fascinating. Now, having the two clones here and seeing maybe some of the freaky similarities and things that they do, but also getting an opportunity to see those difference in preferences as well. But what was the initial motivation or decisions around creating them, for want of a better term, with the clones?
Well, I wasn't really thinking about it at all. We weren't really motivated into doing it at all, really. I think the biggest thing was the cost of it. And then a few people actually approached me and said that they would come in with us to
do the process
and that sort of thing. And I've always been somebody who wants to do my own thing, so I don't like bringing in partners and things like that. So I thought, well, that's not going to work, so I didn't bother. And then a friend of mine in America rang me to say that the cloning company in America was offering at the World
Equestrian Games.
It must have been the Equestrian Games over there at the time or something. We're offering free taking of the biopsies and storing them. So she said to me, would you not do that? And I said, oh, maybe I will. And then they rang me and said, would we do the biopsies? So we did that. And then it sort of went on from there.
And how long,
there's an awful lot of horses in Europe especially and in America that the biopsies are held frozen for. But a lot of them don't go on, but a lot of them do go on. So they charge, you know, a certain fee for
preserving it. And what was the length of time between taking the biopsy as a security and then actually...
I think they went out fresh and they did them fresh, didn't they?
I think they did it straight away.
Well, straight away.
Yeah.
With clones, the fact that it's an exact genetic copy, the temptation might be to not jump them at all, because you could go from the basis of they have nothing to prove because it's the same genetics and the original did all the proving he ever needed to do. What then motivated you to compete them?
Because we were in Ireland and they wouldn't have been used one bit. I thought they would be used more if we jumped them, but I don't know whether they would. I think since let's say it's 10 years ago nearly since we decided to clone. And in that 10 years ago, it was a totally different thing. Show jumping in Ireland was totally different even 10 years ago. I think you'd agree with me.
Yeah, the whole thing has changed a lot. The breeding has changed a lot in 10 years.
Everything's changed. And it's all now, what's the word I'm looking for? It's all...
fashion.
Fashion.
Mm.
It's all fashion now, and it's so totally changed. I to be truthful with you, I don't think... If I'd known the way things would be now, I don't think I'd bother cloning.
Well, I think until they actually jump nearly at a level that cruising was jumping, people are not going to bother that much.
And do you think in the years, say, as they've been competing more and more, has the interest increased, or has it just stayed?
It's just stayed normal.
Has the interest mainly come from those who have had a mare who had already bred well to cruising?
Yeah.
So it's just people trying to replicate across.
It is, yeah.
And people on the continent.
Yeah, we've got quite a few abroad, you know.
Because he was the only, say, Irish or traditionally Irish bred horse that really kind of captured the interest from a breeding perspective of multiple different countries. Like, he's the only one you'll see Dutch bred ones, Belgian bred ones, French bred, McTillard. You know, there's...
I was only going through the file the other day and looking at all the countries that we had to get the breeding regulations for to send the semen out to. You wouldn't believe the amount that he did breed, you know.
In more recent years, you stood Valente here. And do you feel that Valente was underrated by Irish breeders?
100%. I think I've said it to many people, I think he's probably... should be one of the most commercial sires now in Ireland for breeding
dual purpose.
He's probably one of the best dual purpose sires, I think. You know, if you look up the amount that he's had, the amount on the ground that he's had,
his strike rate
and the strike rate of horses jumping up to 140s and eventing is unbelievable.
Because it was something I always wondered about, because when he came out for approval, at the time, he had one of the best approval scores that there had been in a long time, I think, in terms of his scores and how he jumped and that. And then you could say he was ridden by an amateur and a professional. Mm. His foal crops are very small. Mm. And even if you take in the last month, in and around the week of Lanaken, he had your homebred at Lanaken.
Mm.
He had one of the European Championships in eventing.
That's right.
And then...
he won up the filly one up in Balmoral.
And then this weekend, Oliver Townend's Cooley Rosalind, who was he a silver medalist in the Leon last year?
Mm-hmm.
He's now, you know, in the shake-up in the seven-year-olds after cross-country today. And it's tiny, you know, you're talking tiny numbers.
Has he 100 foals on the ground?
I'd be surprised.
I don't think he has, but I can't get people to realise that. Funny enough, Marion Hughes was looking for semen from him this year. I've frozen semen here for the Rossbottoms, and it's particularly good frozen semen. I mean, we get them in foal in one straw. I mean, I don't understand it. I can't understand that. He's the nicest horse I think we ever had here in the yard. He's just a gorgeous horse.
Is there a particular type of mare that you found works really well with them?
The cruisings.
Yeah, I think so.
Fantastic cross.
I think it is.
Any thoughts as to why?
No, well, I mean, isn't he French bred as well?
Yeah.
He's Horlois Lux.
Yeah. I don't know, I can't tell you why, but they just seem to... Well, maybe that's because we like them.
And maybe it's because you're giving him good cruising mares.
Yeah, well, maybe that's it as well. He's bred very well to others as well. I have a smashing colt down there at the moment out of a Sam Gamgee mare. Out of a...
Articue
mare.
In terms of stallions, is there a particular type of stallion that you'd like to add to the roster at the moment? Or is there a particular gap in the market on the stallion side of things that you'd like to fill?
I'd love to have another Valente. I'd think an awful lot of the horse, actually. And I'd like to see our own pair cover more mares and produce more fillies, because I think that's where their niche will be.
Mm.
But Edward's done a great job. And it's not easy like it used to be. I mean, years ago you could go to... a lot of shows that you can't even get to now. Do you know what I mean? To bring on your horses.
Yeah.
They say there's more shows around locally and that sort of thing, but I miss the old days, I have to say. I miss the old days. I miss the shows of 25 years ago.
You were younger then.
Everybody talked to everybody, and now you're looked on as if you're you shouldn't be there. Really.
This is something that I do often think about. When it comes to advice, say a breeder brings a mare into the yard, do you think there's a responsibility on the stallion owners to advise and guide them as to which stallion actually suits the mare?
I do if we saw the mares. We don't see them anymore.
They're just coming and picking up a box.
They're coming and picking up a box.
Yeah, but you have advised them.
I do, yeah.
Certain mares might suit certain horses.
Exactly.
Should go.
We do advise them if we can, but you'd like to be standing there looking at the mare, but you might get a picture of her, you might get a photograph of her, but that'd be about it.
Do you tend to kind of advise them or steer them to what you feel will suit best, or do you just let them off?
Oh, well, you would ask if they were light or heavy or...
Yeah, they'd probably say to me, which one of the two would you go to?
Okay.
And I would say that definitely Encore probably breeds a little bit stronger than Riche.
That's interesting.
But Riche is a lighter horse himself anyway.
There would have been a bit of publicity earlier in the year that the Ashfield Bobby Sparrow was born. Was it a 30-year-old straw that it was conceived with?
33 years old.
It's incredible. And... are we allowed to say that the mare is back in foal again?
Oh,
yeah,
I can, of course.
Mare's back in foal to him
again. Back in foal again to him, yeah.
On one straw.
On one, was it one straw?
One straw. I wouldn't let you take it anymore.
It must be 34-year-old now.
What is it? 34 years old.
It's incredible. And in foal first time.
Mm. But you see, that's my big argument. The owner of the mare, I said to him when he first wanted a few years ago, we did get another mare in foal. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not handing this out at all.
Yeah.
But this particular fellow had a very good mare and he wanted her in foal.
Yeah.
And we got her in foal and he rang me crying to say that he'd gone to leave his daughter to school and when he come back, the mare had foaled and the foal had suffocated in the bag. So I said, I'm putting down the phone now. And anyway, then Leo came and said, would we cover the mare? And I said, I'd only cover the mare if she's clean, if she's 20, you know, if she's not in her foaling heat, she's in her next heat, and that you have seen, the vet has come to her and she has a clean cervical swab, and that everything is 100% right, because I said, I won't waste the semen unless she's 100% right. And she came and she was 100% right. But when you're inseminating these mares with expensive semen, things like that,
yeah, and rare semen, yeah.
And rare semen, they've got to be right, and you've got to draw back. I mean, it's no good throwing semen into a mare and you say, oh, geez, I hope it works. Do you know what I mean? You've got to nearly feel the mare and know it's going to work and that it will work.
Well, it's a limited supply.
That's
of
it,
semen,
yeah.
So.
Mm.
I hope you don't mind covering this now, but I think you've discussed it in bits before, but there'll be plenty of people out there that have heard and discussed the whole rumour about Ashfield Bobby Sparrow and cruising. And I know before you've explained it, but I'd be interested for people that haven't heard it before. How did that rumour come about, and also how did you disprove it or put it to bed, for want of a better word?
I can tell you the three
people
who put it out, but I can't very well name their names. Or I'd be shocked.
We don't need to name them, but do you know how
it was done?
It
was done at a party.
Okay.
Yeah. A few gentlemen got a bit tiddly and were saying that, you know, that cruising was small and he looked like a Connemara, and that the Ashfield Bobby Sparrow was there then and it had to be by Ashfield Bobby Sparrow. And in actual fact, my cousin was at the party and heard it and rang me up and told me. So before it ever came out,
you knew I knew it
was there, you know. And I thought, this is great fun, and left it at that. And the next thing, I must have been bored in the Gopal at that stage as well, knocked on my door and said, we need to do DNA on cruising again. So we did the DNA on cruising again.
I didn't know. I thought it was just that ye had decided to do it to kind of put it to bed. I didn't realise that it had kind of gone that far.
No, the DNA was bored in the Gopal did DNA. And not only that, it had to be done a second time some years later in case we had codded the thing and had it wrong. Or giving them the wrong DNA, or giving them the wrong blood,
just
or something.
Mash it, Bobby,
exactly.
Huh. what young horses that you currently own, the ones we maybe haven't seen out and about, that you either currently own or have sold, are you most excited about? Is there one that really...
Well, we don't. Really, we try and sell them all as foals because we don't have a rider. And, I mean, unless you sell them as foals, you haven't nearly got to go all the way.
Mm.
And, I mean, the sales are getting... The good sales are getting difficult enough to get into.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're nearly taken over now by the big boys, and as I'm sure you'll agree. Mm. And I don't really like going there. So we nearly have them all gone. Have we anything that's...
Frankie.
Stopped. That's only her Connemara's done.
That's not... No, Frankie.
Oh, Frankie. We've one nice filly, yeah.
Okay.
And then we've got 3 2-year-olds.
What's so Frankie? Frankie.
Yeah, I did that on purpose.
Frankie. It's going to be commentators are going to hate
exactly.
You.
Exactly.
She's a full sister to the Ross Bottoms mare that's jumping well.
Clovalent.
Is it Clovalent?
Yeah.
Clovalent, and she's a full sister to one that Peter Charles has called
Where's Waldo,
and he won't sell him, so I'm hoping for that. He's now four, five?
Five.
He's five because she's four.
Okay.
And he thinks a lot of him, so hopefully Peter loves the Valents as well.
So that's Valent out of what sort of a mare?
Cruising Clover Hill King of Diamonds.
Right.
The two Tobago Zed fillies, but they're only yearlings.
Mm.
There's two Valent fillies then. And Anaganics.
Are there goals in breeding that you're still hoping to tick off the list? Is there something that you thought, I'd love to win that, or I'd love to have a horse for that? Are there any that
you
haven't
ticked
off the list?
I hope you'll be good 4-year-old filly, my two.
Yeah, she will.
Is there a particular competition or a particular competition you'd like to win, or a venue you'd love to have a horse in, or a particular kind of like breeding achievement that
I want to
you're
go
still
to
waiting to tick off the list?
I missed Aachen because I was in school. I want to go to Aachen.
That's awful cruel.
I know, she wouldn't give me some time off school to go to Aachen.
For the 4 or 5 times?
Yeah.
I don't think you ever wanted to go to the last time you did.
I wanted to go the last time you wouldn't bring me.
Oh, no, the last time he was going to go, he was going to go with John. And they were going to go to that one.
Johnny retired just before it.
So you'll have to keep going with the clones until you get to
Aachen. Yeah, no, stop.
I end each interview with the same question.
Okay.
But in this instance, I'm going to go in 2 different directions with it. So first is, what advice would you offer a young person or someone at the start of their breeding career? So one direction is that advice for the young breeder. But then specifically, you also have a particular interest in traditionally bred Irish horses. And I'm wondering, for breeders whose focus is specifically traditional, have you any specific advice for them on how you would maybe advise or guide them going forward in their breeding program?
Well, I think for the first one, for the former one, that I would say to young people, a little bit like the Pony Club thing we did, just don't breed from anything. And I mean, everything has got so costly. In the last 2 months, everything has gone sky high. And your veterinary bills are just unbelievable.
Yeah.
And I do feel that before you breed, you need to have a little bit of money behind you, and you need to be able to go out and pay enough for a couple of decent mares.
Mm-hmm.
You need to have the land behind you. It's just not the way it was years ago when the farmer could have 2 or 3 mares on his land and make a good living out of them. Because that's gone. That's totally gone now. So you're either going to have to get people, you know, with the farm, with the initiative and with the money to be able to go out and buy some decent mares. All right, maybe they have a decent mare that they have jumped up to. But I think mares need to have relations that are jumping at the highest level possible, or need to have done it themselves. The only problem is with the one that's done it themselves, you have to wait so long for the...
They're old before you get them.
Before you get them. And you don't really know how good your mare is, because by the time the offspring is 7 or 8 and was showing something, the mare's probably 15 or 16 or 17 and on her way out.
Yeah.
But I do think that, you know, all these teenagers that are going to Limerick University and all this sort of thing and hoping to, you know, become big breeders, unless they've got a big farm behind them and somebody with, you know, a little bit of here was all to be able to afford it. Mm-hmm. It's not easy. It's not easy out there for them.
And then in terms of specifically then, if we think of those that are listening that are breeding specifically to breed traditional Irish sport horses, have you any specific advice or guidance for them?
I think the traditional Irish show jumper has probably gone. But definitely there's still a lot of hope for the traditional Irish event horse. And for them, it's, again, what we were talking about before, it's trying to find the thoroughbred to put on their half-bred mare. And I think to watch, to be very careful, because I'm seeing more of the third generation now of foreign breeding. They're losing it a little bit, whereas before it was the thoroughbred to the Irish horse and they were really producing the eventers that we love. But you just want to be very careful that you're not going down the line that you're breeding from horses that don't like jumping into water and all this sort of thing. You know, that's something that has to be watched.
Okay.
But I think that you'll have to find yourselves thoroughbreds to keep that going.
If you enjoyed this episode or any of the previous episodes, why not send it to a friend or share it on your social media?